here today is going to be primarily working through some of the geographies of settler colonialism through the lens of carcerality, which is a fairly new turn for me since I've joined the Carceral Archipelago Project, of which a bunch of members are presenting here today. My work is always directed towards the analysis of various sorts of structures of colonial domination in my home, with the intent of trying to take these things apart based on the work of critical indigenous scholarship. So that's the sort of political disclaimer to say that as a settler, I don't absent myself from any of the critiques that I make of settler society or people participating in it as I talk here today, and in fact, take all of that as a basis for hopefully future action. So, without further ado, allow me to introduce you to the St. Eugene Mission as it appeared outside of Cranbrook in 1909. So what you're looking at in this slightly grainy picture is an early picture of a First Nations reserve. As you'll see, it doesn't actually look a whole heck of a lot different than a lot of towns might at the turn of the century in what is essentially a rural or frontier area in North America. There are a mix of houses, there are churches, there are structures like stores, there are still some temporary homes, there was still a lot of people who lived in things like teepees at the time. But what you will notice is that there are no walls, there's no gates, there's no security forces around it. And yet, by the 1980s, we have Métis scholar Howard Adams referring to reserves, Métis settlements, reservations in the United States, all these spaces as prisons of grass. Prisons that were essentially created through various forms of isolation. And that is where, on Howard Adams' point that I'm going to pick up today, talking about the idea of these officially recognized Indian territories or government-sanctioned indigenous spaces as forms of carcerality. Now, I want to make clear that one of the things I'm not doing today is I'm not talking about how the residents of these places see or experience these places necessarily. There's been a lot of work by indigenous scholars that has clearly articulated the relationships of indigenous communities to those lands. What I'm talking about here today is the way that governments and settler people have imagined or construed or intended these places and spaces to function. So we've had a number of projects through geography over the years that have looked at different kinds of carceral spaces and about how those spaces are often racialized or how they materialize around particularly racialized bodies. We've looked at Catherine McKittrick's work, I think, is particularly great in the way that the prison system in the United States is part of a continuum of spaces that are imagined for Black Americans to belong only in these very controlled environments. We've similarly seen studies of various kinds about the way that immigrants, migrants, detainees, in border systems of border imperialism are affected and how those shape the societies around them. In 2014, Rob Nichols that argued that prison studies generally have under-examined the importance of indigenous sovereignty in understanding the way that prisons impact on indigenous populations in North America. And I would go a step further than Rob, and I would suggest that the idea of indigenous sovereignty and its challenge to settler colonial regimes by and large changes how we must think about carcerality and carceral spaces beyond just the prison. And we've seen a couple of different presentations today that have pushed us to think about carcerality beyond the prison, and that's really exciting to me because that's basically what I'm going to be doing here. So, taking a step into the sort of the broad theory around the thing, we know that according to theories of settler colonialism, that if there's a difference between settler colonialism and many other kinds of colonialism, is the overwhelming and unending drive of settler colonizers to remove indigeneity from the land. And that can be done in any number of ways, but one of the ways it's most commonly done is by physically removing indigenous bodies from the land. Of course, this is done in order to effect the transfer of that land to a colonizing government, to a colonizing polity in some way. And of course, this can be the actual physical removal of people, the rounding up of people, or it can be the narrative removal such that settlers don't recognize the bodies on the land as indigenous in some way. So terra nullius, of course, reduced indigenous people through its narrative power to aspects of the landscape, literally not perceived as having agency. But a number of historians have critiqued this for being overly broad, and they have very rightly pointed out through a number of different studies that there are times, places, spaces where settler colonies very much maintain indigenous bodies, where spaces are created in which to be indigenous is actually the function of the place, or so it seems. And this has challenged those of us who work with settler colonial theory to work on bringing some nuance into this. And I think that carcerality can help here. I think that this helps us make sense of what Indian territory within the settler imagination is designed to do. So let's talk about reserves and reservations. For any who don't know, the two different words for the same thing, essentially. Reserves in Canada, reservations in the United States. And this project that I'm talking about does very much range across that border. Because by and large, I find the border to be a distraction from what are otherwise some very common dynamics of what's going on here. So reserves and reservations are specific territories that are set aside by the government. The government recognizes them as being governed, and I use that term very loosely, by First Nations or by American Indian bands or governments, depending on which district you're in and how they're discussing it. They were never created by a single systematic means. What they actually were sort of the results of all kinds of different interactions between settler societies and indigenous people, in which, for some reason or another, lands were recognized, granted, protected, fenced off, whatever. And then within the late 19th, early 20th century, both the United States and Canada undertook projects of consolidating and systematizing these recognized lands under systems of reserves and reservations. So something that was backwardly imposed, that took the place of lots of treaty making and things like that that had gone on, and subsumed it into a much larger system of legal and political boundary making. One of the things that I want to point out with this map, this is obviously a map of Canada. This one's easier to use than the American one, but the effect is the same. So these red plots are the locations of all First Nations reserves across Canada. And one of the first things that you will notice is that you can indicate them with dots rather than with borders on a territory, which indicates how small they are. These are entire massive homelands that have been condensed down into tiny dots on a map. The second thing that you'll notice is that in Canada, the vast majority of the population, and I mean the vast majority of the population, lives in a strip right about here along the southern border. You will notice how many reserves are north of that. As soon as we start to go north, we have to start talking about issues of spatial isolation. So the two things that you need to know about most reserves is that they are actually too small to economically sustain themselves, and they are intentionally isolated away from the rest of the political economy of the state. And by intentionally isolated, I mean that one of the things that often happens is the government neglects to intentionally construct infrastructure that would connect these places. So, for example, there's a place right about here, which doesn't look so far outside of where the Canadian population is, called Shoal Lake 40, who's been on a boil water advisory for about 2 decades. And the reason why isn't because there's not a desire or a will or money to build a water treatment facility there, it's because there's no road to actually bring the equipment in to do it. And it's only literally a few miles away from one of the major cities of Canada, Winnipeg. So, when we say isolated and impoverished, we have to remember that these things are quite intentionally created conditions. So I would argue as well that in order to understand reserves, you have to understand a number of other different kinds of spaces that have been created. So to understand reserves as carceral, we need to understand the different other spaces in which Indigenous people are actively incarcerated within Canada and the United States. Two of those that are germane to this discussion are schools and prisons. And so when we talk about schools, we're primarily talking about residential and industrial schools, which were the boarding schools that both Canada and the United States did, and in the case of the United States still does, where Indigenous children are pulled out of their communities and sent away to be re-educated. And it's exactly as close to cultural genocide as it sounds, which is to say exactly the same. So this is a picture from the Port Alberni residential school in the 1950s, and you can see things like the uniform haircuts, the Western clothing. What you can't see in this picture, and I think this is very interesting, is there's no teachers, but you know that they're there, this sort of ever-present authority figures. And so there has been some work that's been starting to examine these spaces as carceral. Wolford and James Gasick, who I believe is here, have just written a paper on that this year, and it's really good, and I think that's important to recognize. And then there is also the issue of prisons, which are already sort of the main issue. when we talk about indigenous people and incarceration, prisons are a pressing issue for indigenous people generally. We know that there's massive overrepresentation of indigenous people in the carceral system, the prison system in the United States and Canada. And so I put both of those up here, even though they've been recognized as some form of carceral space that particularly affects indigenous people, in part to emphasize that there is some work going on in this area, but also to extend outward from there so that we can start to consider other spaces. And of course, in this case, the one that I want to look at is the reserve. So I've developed this kind of idea that I'm still working through. This is all the beginning of a project that I hope to carry out over the next year or so, of a sort of interlocking system of carceral spaces designed specifically in some way to capture indigeneity, in which indigenous people are forced to move through these circuits of carcerality. And I really like that concept from the earlier session today. I will be liberally swiping that. And what happens is each one of these spaces is designed to be unpleasant and to restrict people into that space. And the avenues of escape from it almost invariably lead directly into another one of these spaces. So indigenous people are put into this bind of escaping carcerality only by subjecting themselves to different forms of carcerality. So that's the bear theory. And we'll look at a couple of ways that this gets operationalized, and I'll come back to it in a second. So one of the first things that happens around reserves that makes them very carceral is the way that both the physical environment and legal regimes have intersected to create an isolating environment. So I've mentioned the spatial isolation of being out in the wilderness and about how that becomes a problem for resources and infrastructure. But there has also been very literal attempts by the state to keep people on reserves. And this goes along with the way that in the early 20th century, when these places were being incorporated into the system of carceral spaces for indigenous people, the idea at the time was to use these as holding pens for people who were seen as in natural civilizational decline. Essentially, put indigenous people there long enough and they will disappear. The work of time will make them go away. Of course, that never happened, but the space remains and it still does that operation. But we can see that logic in the way that things like the system of passes and Indian agents worked to keep people confined onto reserves. So for much of the 20th century, there was a policy that a person could only leave a reserve if they had a specific pass, like this one, signed by an Indian agent. And without that, you were not allowed to be off reserve. If a person left a reserve without a pass, the Indian agent could call the police. Keeping in mind, the person had not broken a law. This was a policy. It was not legal. It was just a policy. But the Indian agents would call the police, who would physically go and drag the person back to the reserve, effectively incarcerating a person without having committed a crime. So that's just one example of how people were physically incarcerated on reserves. Going along with that was the environmental conditions and the economic conditions that tended to create weakened, docile bodies due to starvation, lack of malnutrition, and that sort of thing. And I want to give a shout out here to the work of Billy Ray Belcourt, who right at the time that I was starting to develop these ideas submitted a paper to a journal I'm the editor of, Settler Colonial Studies, and it hasn't come out yet, but when it does, I would invite everyone to read it, because Billy Ray has developed some great ideas around how things like diabetes are used in order to keep people immobile as a health condition and an effect of settler colonialism. I know that I'm close to end of time here. We're going to skip a couple of slides here. Just want to talk about the way that police get used in all of this to bring home the fact that state force is used to harden these boundaries. But this is kind of the main point that I want to finish on here. So you'll see that I've replaced residential schools with the idea of in care. That's in part because we now, although Canada has shut down residential schools, we now have more Indigenous children in foster care than were in residential schools at the height of their operation. And also because people are brought into care, mental health programs and all sorts of other care programs that function in a carceral way. So what happens is, as I mentioned, people are subjected to these nasty conditions and they try to escape those conditions. Each move through the system results in either a move into the next carceral space or some form of self-elimination, accepting it's enfranchisement, which absolves the government from any obligation to you as an Indian. Self-assimilation, which stops the self-identification of being an Indigenous or an Aboriginal person and therefore ends the cultural connection to the land, so on and so forth. Each one of these places provides a different opportunity for some kind of colonial reform. And along with that, if a person does not choose to exit the carceral spaces that way, there's this carceral churn of just continuing to move through these terrible spaces, each one which inflicts some form of different harm on the people within that space. And we result in either a bodily death or a social absence from the rest of settler space that results in an unchallenging settler dominance and perception of normal. And of course, the reason I put this here, this idea of go back where you came from, is that indigenous people, when they do step outside of these spaces as indigenous into settler space, are seen as not belonging, even if they are on their own homeland. The issue of the urban ghettos there at the end is something that I'm hoping to get into in future research. For example, what happens when indigenous people who have been segregated into particular urban neighborhoods like the downtown east side in Vancouver start making their presence felt in other parts of the city. So that's an interesting potential future point of research here. And so I'll just finish up by saying I have a bunch of future questions that I would like to ask that potentially cross over into other areas of research. I will leave them here for your perusal, and thank you very much for your attention.